Now here's Professor Kathy Willis, the Director of Science of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, with an omnibus edition of her new history of our changing relationship with plants in Plants From Roots to Riches.
How do plants move? Charles Darwin argued about it. Scientists pored over it for centuries. Then in 1934, a relatively unsung hero of botanical science called Kenneth Thyman isolated the chemical responsible, a growth hormone called auxin. It provided the key to understanding plants' ability to respond to all sorts of changes in the environment and influencing a range of processes in higher plants, from the growth of roots to timing of flowering. To some, it was the equivalent of the discovery of the nervous system in animals, and for which, half a century later, Thyman would go on to receive the Boltzmann Prize, the biggest award in science outside of the Nobels. It had been known for a long time that plants move in response to external stimuli. The French name for the sunflower is tournesol, meaning the flower which turns with the sun. Some thought movements were purely mechanical, whereas others believed they reflected some form of sensitivity or awareness to things around it, like touch or even music. Plant movement became an increasingly hot topic for plant scientists in the second half of the 18th century. Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus, was an early proponent of what became known as the sensationalist position, arguing that plants were sensitive organisms with a voluntary power of motion. They moved because they chose to. He went so far as to suggest that buds contained a brain that reacted to sensory stimuli, and also that plant behaviour relied at least in part on learned behaviour. As historian Jim Endersby explains, Charles Darwin started to look for scientific evidence behind this movement.
Initially, he's interested in things like mimosa, the sensitive plant, which reacts to touch, to carnivorous plants. He's always fascinated by plants that act in this strangely animal-like way of devouring insects. Climbing plants are a great fascination because of their apparent ability to sense when there is something for them to climb up. He actually writes to his son William, "My hobby horse at present is tendrils. They are more sensitive to a touch than your finger, and wonderfully crafty and sagacious." And the thought that plants can be crafty and intelligent almost is a very new thought.
But if plants had no nervous system, how could they tell what was going on outside? Darwin carried out some very simple experiments to work out how plants react to light. He enlisted the help of his son Francis in the greenhouse in his back garden in Kent. They grew canary grass. Just like your pot plant on your windowsill at home, it leant towards the light. But what made it lean? How did it know which way to move? These elegant experiments, so simple but never bettered, are still carried out to this day by biology students everywhere.
Darwin and his son tried covering the tips of the plants with little tiny hats that blocked the light out. And sure enough, the grass seedlings don't bend when you do that. They then tried covering the base of the seedling and leaving the tip exposed, and the plants bend. So it's something in the tip that causes the bending. So they try cutting the tips off. Sure enough, no bending. And then the crucial clinching experiment, which is so simple and elegant, they take a little tiny bit of agar gel and they cut the grass tips off and they put this on the gel and leave it there for a few hours. And then they take the little piece of gel and put that back onto the grass stem. And lo and behold, the grass stems bend towards the light. So it's clear that there's a substance, a chemical of some sort, produced in the tip of the plant, which then travels down into the rest of the body of the plant and affects its growth, basically making the cells grow faster on one side than the other so that the plant bends towards the light.
At first, Darwin's ideas were dismissed. Whatever chemical it was, there wasn't much of it. By 1934, it had taken Kenneth Thyman over 5 years to purify enough of it to analyse and finally identify it as being indoleacetic acid, whereupon it was given the name auxin. Mystical ideas about conscious plants listening to Mozart could now be safely jettisoned. We now know that auxins are just one in a suite of hormones that are known to naturally control various functions within plants. One of the most powerful plant hormones is gibberellin, which promotes flowering, seed dormancy and a host of other activities. Viswambaram Sarasan, in Kew's Conservation Biotechnology Unit, works with one of the many variants of the gibberellins we're now familiar with, gibberellic acid 3 or GA3. For him, GA3 is a useful tool to ensure elongated stems when propagating young trees, an important requirement if the tree is to go on to develop a healthy root system.
We have done some work on woody plants, and micropropagation of trees is difficult. The elongation process is very important because you need to get good quality materials from these shoot cultures to take them to the next stage, that is the rooting phase. So if they don't elongate properly, you don't get good quality shoot cultures. So GA3, or one of the gibberellins, gibberellic acid 3, GA3 can be added to the culture medium so that you may get shoot elongation. And we have got very good quality cultures from applying GA3 to the medium.
It's this dramatic effect by gibberellin of increasing stem height that lay behind a problem that rice farmers in Asia had long been concerned with. Plant pathologists in Japan had first described the effects at the end of the 19th century while studying bacani, foolish seedling disease, a condition that was seriously lowering the yield of rice crops across Asia. Seedlings, instead of growing strong, quite literally grew tall and fell over. The first paper on the cause of bacani was published in 1898 by the pathologist Shotaro Hori, who demonstrated that the symptoms appeared to be generated by infection with a fungus. Then, in 1935, Tajiro Yabuta was able to show that it was the fungus itself that was causing the rice's unrestrained growth and toppling. He was able to isolate the culprit from the fungus, which he christened gibberellin. But it wasn't until after the Second World War that news of the discovery spread through the scientific community. The race was then on to work out how gibberellin worked, and in doing so, harness its powerful effects. This control of height in crops was to become the most crucial factor in the success of the so-called Green Revolution, which was to transform agricultural practices and dramatically increase global grain production in the developing world from feeding 1 billion people in the late 1950s to 2 billion by the end of the 20th century. Professor Nick Harbord of Oxford University studies plant growth and the impact of gibberellins in plants.
A major component of the Green Revolution was the use of mutant or variant dwarf varieties of crops, wheat and rice, for example, which were much higher yielding than was previously possible because they're more robust. They tend not to fall over, you know, in response to wind and rain. And also, they use their energy in a way that favours grain development over stem development.
So their energy is in the actual grain itself rather than in the height of the plant?
Absolutely. So these varieties were enormously influential in the Green Revolution, and they kind of swept around the world. And there were both rice and wheat varieties that are particularly pertinent here. So the rice semi-dwarf varieties of the Green Revolution are mutant forms of rice that actually lack enzymes that are involved in making the hormone. So these are plants that are effectively hormone deficient or have much lower levels of hormone than normal.
There's lower levels of gibberellin in there?
Much lower levels of gibberellin in those plants. So that was the sort of cause of the rice component of the Green Revolution. The wheat component also involves the hormone gibberellin, but it does it in a different way. These now are semi-dwarf wheat varieties are less responsive to the hormone. So they make the hormone. In fact, interestingly, they make more of it than a normal plant does, but they lack the capacity to respond to the hormone.
Many of the Revolution's breeding programmes were pioneered by the agricultural botanist Norman Borlaug. He'd witnessed famine at home in Minneapolis during the Great Depression, fueling his desire to join the Rockefeller Foundation's Mexican Hunger Project in 1944 to generate rust-resistant varieties of wheat. By the early 60s, Borlaug had begun to introduce dwarfing genes into high-yielding wheat varieties. One of his most notable creations was Norin 10, a semi-dwarf variety with high-yielding ears. At the same time, other scientists were doing something similar with dwarf rice. They might not have known that it was the plant's response to gibberellins they were altering, but the results were dramatic. Borlaug's dwarf wheat was credited with saving perhaps a billion people from starvation in Mexico, Pakistan and India. His achievement would earn him the 1970 Nobel Prize, not for science, but for peace. Nick Harbord and his team at Oxford have been using genetics to work out the molecular identity of dwarfism and finding out how plants respond to the gibberellin hormone.
We began by making use of a plant which carries a mutation which makes it insensitive to the hormone. So it's a dwarf plant, looks very similar to plants that can't make the hormone, but this one, it's not that it can't make the hormone, it's that it can't respond to the hormone. And essentially, using the kind of peculiar inverse logic of genetics, whereby when things don't work, that's how you work out how they do work, we were able to identify the gene that encodes a protein that's part of the process by which the plant responds to the hormone. And essentially what this protein does is it actually acts as a brake on growth. So you can imagine it like this. So the protein stops the plant from growing, but in the presence of the hormone, it's like taking your foot off the brake, and the hormone stops the brake from working. So what we came to understand from our work was that gibberellin promotes the growth of plants, actually effectively by overcoming the effect of a brake on the growth of plants. So in the gibberellin-insensitive plants of the Green Revolution, what you actually have is a mutant form of this protein that is itself insensitive to the hormone. So it carries on acting as a brake on growth even in the presence of hormone. And of course, Norman Borlaug and others were able to use, in the case of wheat, this mutant gene in their crop breeding without knowing the actual identity of the gene that they were using, and that was fine.
But it's just a break on the height rather than anything else in the growth of the plant?
Actually, the height is the most obvious, but it does have a number of other effects. For example, it does make the grain slightly smaller. As with many great advances, it's a trade-off, is that there's good things and bad things about it. And indeed, you know, our modern approaches to agriculture, we have to realise that Green Revolution was built partly on dwarf varieties. It was also built partly on excessive use of nitrogen fertiliser, and we have to think about ways of developing our crops in a more sustainable way, whereby we use the good things about the Green Revolution and try to improve on the things that were not so good.
The Green Revolution and its spectacular increase in plant yields during the second half of the 20th century through harnessing the effect of gibberellin had come at a price. Aside from a high dependence on nitrogen fertilisers, there emerged an increasing reliance on a few high-yielding species that in itself was to dramatically reduce biodiversity. The way we used our planet was changing rapidly. Urbanisation and new agricultural practices were increasing demand on available land. What we meant by biodiversity and how we mapped and measured it were becoming ever more pressing questions. And as we're here, answering them would rely on one of the most important, yet most basic tools in conservation, floras.
Unlocking biodiversity.
In 1948, researchers began an ambitious project to survey and catalogue plants of an area of Africa comprising modern-day Tanzania, Kenya and Uganda. They began with high hopes of finishing quickly. The first volume was ready within 4 years, so by 1952, confidence was high.
Publication has commenced on the flora of tropical East Africa, and a number of families have been published. We estimate it will take another 15 years to complete.
The project was finally finished 60 years later. It turned out to be the largest regional flora ever assembled, covering one of the biggest and most biodiverse regions of Africa.
We wound up with 263 volumes in the end, and it occupies a metre and a half of shelf space, or a very large box.
With all due respect, you're not going to take that into the field, are you?
I know one person who does it. It's a big trunk in a big Land Rover.
Flora is Latin for flowers. Scientists also use the word as shorthand for the complete range of plants which inhabit a particular region, as in flora and fauna. And by extension, it's used as the generic name for a book in which those plants are catalogued, described and often lavishly illustrated. The best floras are both exquisite works of art and an essential reference resource for botanists and plant enthusiasts. Your flora is therefore a necessity both on your laboratory shelf and in your rucksack out in the field, although you'll need a big rucksack. Henk Bencher is the last of six editors who oversaw the flora of tropical East Africa from its origins in 1948.
There wasn't much known about the wild plants. There was no list. Nobody knew how many there were. It was very difficult to identify them. Many plants were used, but you couldn't put a proper scientific name onto them. And a flora enables you to name the species. It enables communication about wild species. Conversely, if there is no flora, you can't really communicate, and all scientific work doesn't get off base, really.
So in a sense, you're unlocking the biodiversity of the region with the flora.
You do indeed. And not only unlocking it, but you increase it as well. The flora was originally started in 52. At that time, they thought there might be as many as 7,500 species in East Africa, Uganda, Kenya and Tanzania. And in the end, it was about 12,000, and 1,500 species were described as new during the project. So we not just inventoried, but we found a lot of new things as well.
A flora is much more than simply a list of species. By accurately recording what grows where, these books can help address questions such as global patterns of diversity and the importance of particular plant families within an environment. As floras develop, they can also help us understand how species richness and composition change over time. So what's in a flora? Well, for each species, as well as an identification key, there's a wealth of information on the biology, distribution and habitat preference, as Henk Bencher showed me.
The first section includes bibliographical data.
So we've got things like K.B.1949. What does that refer to?
That was the original, the very first description of this particular species in Kew Bulletin.
Those are all the places that the original description is published.
That's correct.
The next section, I understand, a climbing or scrambling plant, younger stems covered with pale, rusty or golden hair. So that would be useful to your average botanist.
That's the botanical description, including the local variation and things like that. It gives all the measurements for all the various parts. It gives the range of, say, flower colour, fruit taste, whatever.
And then at the bottom here, we have distributional information.
Both within and outside East Africa, information on the habitat, in this case that it occurs on the edges of forest clearings and in lowland rainforest. It gives the altitude range.
So in less than a paragraph, you've got this incredible amount of information about that one species. And is it possible to give an estimation of how long it takes to do one family?
My best family ever was a single family on a Wednesday afternoon. There was only one species in that family.
What family was that?
It was Restionaceae. And the other end of the scale, I also worked on Compositae, Asteraceae, and that took me 10 years, but there were 900 species in that.
All the leading botanists have used floras. Carl Linnaeus, amongst others, used them to address questions about classification and evolution. Kew's Joseph Hooker, in the mid-19th century, produced a number of floras on the plants of Antarctica, New Zealand, Tasmania, the Himalayas and India, and used this global resource to map and describe species across continents. These insights had a powerful effect on the imagination of scientists. We might think that biodiversity is a new discipline, but the tradition of using floras in this way goes back centuries. The flora of tropical East Africa remains the biggest such project ever undertaken. It reflects the intense biodiversity of East Africa. Habitats in the region vary radically from the grasslands of the Serengeti through to the dense rainforests of Uganda and the Afro-Alpine moorlands of Kilimanjaro. The region provides a home for a staggering 4% of the world's flora, including highly distinctive local residents like the baobab tree, the Cape chestnut and the camphor bush. Around 2,500 of the species included are endemic, meaning that they are not found anywhere else. Concerns have been expressed that without protection, they face threats from human pressures. This is where the flora, especially one containing information dating back over hundreds of years, has now evolved as a valuable tool for conservation, as Ian Derbyshire, curator of African Botany at Kew, explains.
Until we know what the total species diversity in a region is, where the most diverse areas within that region are, and what are the rarest species, the most threatened species, then really how can we do conservation? We can't prioritise conservation properly. So having a documentation of all the species of a region is so important, and they are really the starting point on which you can do more practical conservation and land management work.
Quentin Luke is a botanist at the National Museum of Kenya who regularly uses volumes of the flora in the field for conservation assessment. In some ways, Luke personifies the old-fashioned no-frills plant collector ethic. When asked to assess the impact of potential mining projects on the flora of a region, he famously packs all 200 volumes of the flora of tropical East Africa in the back of his Land Rover.
The key element is being able to point to a species and say, this one is known to be rare, what they call species of conservation significance. If they're actually found within the area, the footprint area or the area of impact, then they have to do something about it. In areas where floras haven't been done, you have to collect very much more, completely blind, and then you'll get back and you'll find that you actually missed the rare thing, you actually just collected a whole lot of the common stuff. But in the field, you can sort that out with the flora.
In helping to strengthen particular concepts of the nature of individual species, the botanical illustration in a flora is a powerful tool. It's a craft that's barely changed since the great botanical impresario Joseph Banks first employed an artist on board the Endeavour. Remarkably, these illustrations are still done by hand to reveal proper analysis, and they conform to strict scientific style. This isn't mere sketching. Lucy Smith is a botanical artist at Kew and explains the process.
I'll begin by drawing what we call the habit of the plant. In this case, it's a piece of grass which shows you the roots, the rhizome, the stem, the leaves coming off it, and eventually the flowers coming off it. And then I go into the flowering details because they're really important at describing the differences between species. So I have a floret, which in grasses consists of a unit of two flowers, and the bracts that enclose them. Some of these florets are really tiny.
You are using a microscope then to look at this and draw this, is that right?
That's right, yes. That's where I absolutely have to use a microscope.
So what's the difference then between having a photograph and having a drawing? Why should we have a drawing?
Oh, that's the question that all botanical illustrators get asked. With a photograph, you're just seeing one aspect of the plant at one point in its life. That definitely will not tell you everything you need to know about that plant. That makes it different from every other species. You can highlight what are the important details and take emphasis away from the unimportant details. If you're dissecting a flower, you can really show very, very clearly how those flowering parts, such as the filaments holding up the anthers, are attached to the petals.
Because in a sense, you're the person that's illustrating why this is a new species.
In very close collaboration with the botanist, but you do feel quite a great sense of responsibility. You can't make anything up. It has to be completely accurate and true to that one, or sometimes more than one, specimen.
Hand-drawn illustrations will remain an essential part of these flora projects until the digital age finds a better way of doing it, which doesn't look like happening soon. What technology can do, of course, is increase everyone's access to floras through so-called e-floras. Many e-flora projects are underway around the world, including a project at Kew to get the plants of the whole world online, of which the flora of tropical East Africa will be part.
That's where we would like to see the flora going in the future, having it in its original form, but then linked to more user-friendly resources, particularly photographs of plants. Although, interestingly, the flora of tropical East Africa, which took 60 years to write, comprises only less than 5% of the global flora, so you can see the magnitude of the task in hand. But at least this is the largest regional flora ever completed, so it's a great start for documenting African plant diversity.
Some floras cover areas defined by natural features, like a desert or mountain range. Others, political regions, like a country. E-flora or not, for all their simplicity, they will always be an essential part of an interconnected library of data about biodiversity. Unlike plants, some things never change.
An ill wind.
The Arboretum here at Kew is, in my view, a perfect microcosm of the English landscape. Sturdy spreading oak, ash and beech trees stand sentinel amidst a host of other species, as they have in the parks and woods of England for centuries. As dawn broke on October the 16th, 1987, this scene looked very different. It was the morning after a great storm in which hurricane-force winds ripped through southern England, recording gusts of 110 miles per hour and bringing down a staggering 15 million trees in a few hours. Here at Kew, 700 trees lay flattened on the ground. But the carnage reaped some surprising benefits. Experts were able to rewrite the textbooks on a number of aspects of tree care, how we build resilience into the landscape, and indeed what role arboretums should play today. In this episode, we're on a walk to examine the hurricane's legacy. Tony Kirkham, head of Kew's Arboretum, is showing me around. And we're starting with a remarkable story from that night of carnage. It centres around an oak tree, a Quercus turneri, an elegant hybrid cross between an English oak and a holly oak. It's been here a long time, given to Princess Augusta, Kew's founder, in 1783 by an amateur gardener called Mr. Turner. It's a beautiful specimen, dense and spreading, the perfect English tree. And Tony Kirkham, on the night of the great hurricane, it did something very peculiar indeed.
4 o'clock in the morning, I remember it very well, and most people who look after trees or have an interest in trees will remember that evening. The whole tree lifted out of the ground, so the whole root plate that we are stood on lifted and cracked and exposed some of the roots. But luckily, because it's got this very low branching habit, the tree literally sat back down into the hole that it had made and didn't fall over.
What did you and your team then do the morning after the hurricane? I mean, did you have some sort of triage system in place to decide which trees to deal with?
When we came in on the morning, it was doom and gloom. Over 200 years of tree history gone or damaged in that one night. I suppose we went round just to assess what had happened, to make sure things were safe. Obviously, we had a massive clean-up operation ahead of us, and we decided to leave this tree to the end, and this will be the last tree that we would cut up.
When you eventually got to it, what had happened to it?
Well, before the hurricane, we'd been monitoring the health of it, like we do with all our other trees in Kew, and what we'd noticed is that it was going into decline. The leaves were very small on it, so the density of the canopy was very thin. We wouldn't have been able to shelter under it today. And we didn't really know the reason why. And then after 3 years of clearing up, we came back to this tree to deal with it. And remarkably, it was a picture of health.
So how on earth did bodily wrenching the roots from the ground before the whole tree thumped back down again improve the oak's health?
Basically, because of the high visitor numbers that we have at Kew, and because this was such a popular tree to shelter under, this tree had basically been suffering for a long time, unbeknown to us, from compaction. So basically, overnight, the storm broke up the compaction, got oxygen down to the roots, allowed water to get into the roots, and then the tree started its second life. And it's put on a third of its overall size in the last 26, 27 years since the hurricane.
So did you suspect many other trees also having the same problem in Kew?
All the other trees in Kew, particularly our heritage trees and our big trees that we do decompaction work to, owe their future to this tree. This is the tree that sort of set the scene for a lot of the remedial work that we do around tree roots. Today we use a tool called an air spade, pushing compressed air in, which runs through the soil, shatters the soil around the roots without damaging the roots. A remarkable piece of kit that, you know, I think has revolutionised the tree world.
So Tony, there were all these losses as a result of the hurricane. What did you do to start filling the gaps?
First of all, we had a blank canvas to work on, which is a unique opportunity. And one of the important things that we had to get right was tree establishment in these gaps. And so we started to look very closely at how we plant trees. We should have a walk, and I'll show you some young trees that have been planted since the hurricane.
Tony, you've brought us to the edge of the Arboretum, where we can look back on 240 acres that make up the collection of trees here. And we're surrounded by some very young American ash. These, what, 2 years old? Each just 2 metres high, nurtured from seed, and very carefully planted, I see.
Well, you're absolutely right. We're in the ash collection now, which is probably one of our most important collection holdings in the Arboretum, mainly because of the threats to the ash tree. We're looking for 100% success rate. to replenish the collections from the hurricane. So one of the things we looked at was how do we plant trees and how can we be more successful? Because we only get one go at some of these.
So what did you learn?
The first thing we did was to trawl all the scientific research. You talk to people and they say, oh, we need more research in this, we need more research in that. In actual
fact,
that's a typical science.
Yep.
And there is a huge amount of research from America, from Europe, from Australia, from Asia on tree planting. And basically we trawled through it and pulled out the pieces that we thought would be more appropriate to tree planting in a temperate climate, and came up with probably the first tree planting specification at Kew. So we found, you know, from the hurricane, from the tree root survey, we realised that tree roots were shallow. You know, at school we were all taught that what you see above ground is what you get below ground, and across the southeast of England, 15 million trees blew over, and they all had very shallow root plates, which was a bit of a rude awakening for us. It was a surprise, you know, and tree root plates between half a metre and a metre deep at the best of times.
I think that'd still be a big surprise to many people.
And even to professionals, Cathy, that work on trees all the time, it's very difficult to comprehend. And here at Kew, from the tree root survey, we know that there are very few roots deeper than 800 millimetres, and they sit on this raft, and it's all about friction and spread to stand up. Now, we were digging tree pits over a metre deep. In 200 years, those tree roots are never going to go down to the bottom of that hole, so why are we digging trees too deep? Most trees are killed by being planted too deep. It's a slow, painful death for a tree.
And what about the shape of the hole? I mean, is there anything to learn from that?
We complain about trees grown in circular pots because the roots spiral, and so we looked at all different shapes and eventually came up that the square hole was the easiest to dig, and you've got four corners that the roots can break out of, and they're very quick to look for moisture. And also you'll notice we plant small. We don't need to stake, and tree staking damages trees, and you've got to prepare these trees for the next hurricane, the next 1987 storm. And if we put tree stakes and supports and canes and tie these trees up, then they don't get used to being moved, and they need to move. Any wind, they sway, and that swaying motion encourages good anchor roots, increased increment on the trunk to support the crown, and they're ready for the next storm. We call that seismomorphogenesis.
So you've just turned all my understanding about tree planting on its head.
But it's all good stuff, and you know, it's based on observation, trialing things, and research papers.
And natural ecosystems.
And natural ecosystems, yeah.
When we began our walk under the Turner Oak, you said that the immediate aftermath of the hurricane was all doom and gloom. But I sense that more benefits came out of it than you could have ever imagined.
When I look back now, in retrospect, I think so many good things have come from the hurricane. I think public awareness is raised, so people appreciate trees more and have more respect for them. We learnt so much about tree roots. We reinvented tree planting techniques. And we've mounted many expeditions bringing new material back. Although it's one of the oldest arboreta in the world, it's now a young arboretum as well, with lots of young trees to go into the next century.
So the disturbance regime was a rejuvenation as well?
Absolutely. You know, the root work that we've learnt about, the decompaction work that's revitalised all these mature trees around us, is another plus from the hurricane.
It's been a delight walking around the arboretum. Tony Kirkham, thank you.
Capsules of Life.
One of the most striking differences between animals and plants is that we have legs and wings and they don't. We can move freely around the globe at will, while they are quite literally rooted to the spot. Well, not quite. There is one period of the life cycle of the plant during which it makes itself entirely portable. The seed. Seeds carry life to pastures new, allowing plants to spread, diversify, and survive. So important is this short-lived ability to move that they have evolved many ingenious ways of hitching a lift around the planet. By air, by water, by an animal.
Seeds can tell you an awful lot about a plant's lifestyle, if you like.
They have evolved over many, many millions of years. If a seed does not work, the species goes extinct. So everything you see around today must somehow work. And that is surprising when you look at all those crazy shapes and sizes and colours you encounter in the wild.
That was Wolfgang Stuppi, a seed morphologist at Kew's Millennium Seed Bank. It was Russian botanist Nikolai Vavilov who pioneered the storing of seeds, collecting wild relatives of food crops in the first seed bank in St. Petersburg during the early 20th century. His concern was that selective breeding by farmers would diminish the natural store of genetic diversity. By the 1980s, scientific concern had also moved on to the fate of wild plants in their natural ecosystems. By 1992, the Rio Earth Summit on Sustainable Development concluded that conservation in the field needed to be complemented by methods away from a plant's natural habitat, such as seed banking. In the jargon, in situ protection in the field is matched with ex situ preservation in a seed vault.
It's not quite like Noah's Ark. It's a working collection for bona fide research.
Kew Seed Bank is housed at its country estate at Wakehurst Place in Sussex. It was opened in 2000 under the appropriate title Millennium Seed Bank. It's the largest ex situ plant conservation programme in the world, with the ambitious target of banking 25% of endemic and economically valuable plant species by 2020. And insurance against the risk of extinction in their native habitat.
Well, you can see we've got four cold rooms now. One is already full, two are nearly full. The fourth one is about ready to be switched on.
Once collected from their natural habitat, seeds are taken to the labs at Wakehurst, where they're slowly dried and cooled to slow the natural processes of deterioration. The ideal place to find dry air and constant low temperatures required is deep underground.
So it's freezing cold in here, even if Janet says it's not really. I think it is.
Janet Terry, head of seed preparation at the MSB, is my guide to this subterranean storehouse.
This is the final stage of preparing the seeds to go into the vault. So they've been cleaned, they've had an x-ray sample, they've had their seed numbers determined, then they come down into this room for a minimum of a month so that they will equilibrate to the same relative humidity as the room, as will all the containers that we're going to put the seeds into.
So then they go into these very large walk-in cold rooms.
This is it. This is what we called long-term storage. So the collections are designed to survive for tens, hundreds, thousands of years.
And how many species are in here now?
Over 30,000 species. And these cold rooms are the world's biggest biodiverse hotspot. So where you're standing now is the biggest plant hotspot on the planet.
Vavilov had really started something. There are now more than 1,300 seed banks all over the world. But the early pioneers of seed banking presented science with a series of challenges as well as opportunities. How long will each variety survive being kept? How do you wake up a seed following storage? Knowing the quality and longevity of seeds is vital if they're to be put to good use in the real world. Particularly urgent is the need to examine their resilience to climate change. Scientists at the MSB have been investigating the impact of climate variability on seed quality, for example, by withholding water from sunflower fields and then examining the size of seeds and their ability to germinate. The potential economic and social impact of negative responses to environmental stress among food crops could hardly be more important. Hugh Pritchard is head of seed conservation research.
It could be that those environmental changes will affect one of the inherent properties of seeds that we can bank, and it could be that we're in for a nasty surprise that actually the seeds store less well as a result of that climate change. And one of our predictions is that the likely conditions in Europe, based on not Kew's work but the University of Reading, that the environmental conditions in Northern Europe will be more similar to Turkey or North Africa by 2060. And so what we're choosing from our collection of wild species are those which we have in the vault from those southern European locations, on the basis that we would anticipate that germplasm is already adapted to those environmental stresses. And then ultimately, of course, what we hope we would be arguing is that those species could indeed be the ones that contribute to improving the stress tolerance of the more frequently used northern European crops.
Because seeds can lie dormant in soil for a long time, they can survive many above-ground challenges, including fire, drought and freezing. Seeds are, in effect, the plant equivalent of a time capsule. It's this ability of seeds to lie dormant below ground that means that plants have incredible recovery potential despite human and climatic perturbations. It was once commented, if you go into a zoo and hammer all the animals on the head, you'd have the end of the zoo. In contrast, if you went into a botanic garden and scythed or burnt all the plants, 10 years later, you'd have a botanic garden again. Of course, neither course of action would be a very good idea, and I'd certainly be without a job. But the sentiment is correct. Plants can and do return from the dead via the seed bank. As a result of this process and some others, plants display incredible longevity. And what scientists are increasingly finding is that whilst the seeds are persisting, often the agents of dispersal of these seeds are not. Take the example of the world's biggest flower, the Rafflesia. Wolfgang Stuppi.
I've never read about it in the literature, who disperses the fruit or which animal. What I read was that somebody assumed it must be rodents because there was the only animals observed in Southeast Asia in the forest. You'd get all sorts of animals feeding on every kind of fruit. Yeah. That does not mean they are the co-adapted yeah. disperser. When I read the characteristics, how this fruit has this pulp that smells kind of yeasty inside. Now, when you go to Africa and you look at elephant dispersed fruits, they have this characteristic yeasty, oh. not particularly pleasant smell. And then I immediately thought that it's the Asian elephant.
So the elephant likes that, particularly likes that sort of smell. But there isn't an Asian elephant.
No, because the Asian elephant is an extremely endangered species and hardly present anymore in the habitats where you find Rafflesia. That disperser isn't there.
So what do you do at that point then? If the aim is to restore a species, but you no longer have its main herbivore disperser, how do we restore to those environments?
You either have to be a gardener for as long as you want this species to persist, basically until eternity or whatever, or you get the animal back.
Save the elephant means saving all the species that depend on the elephant too. Where elephants have disappeared, populations of plants which use them for seed dispersal have dropped by up to 95%. It's not that easy finding another animal willing to eat the fruit of the Rafflesia, the size of a grapefruit, with almost no flesh and a stone the size of a cricket ball.
Germination is basically reduced by 95% if you take the elephants away, because the pulp rots and destroys the seedlings or the embryos in the seeds. So it's a 95% reduction of the viability of those seeds, and everyone can imagine what that means for the population of that plant, apart from the fact that the seeds don't get to travel anymore. The seed is the only phase in the plant's life where it can travel.
Yeah.
And so it's a very crucial moment in the life of a plant, and that's why you have all these incredible adaptations to getting around somehow, one way or another, be it wind, water, animals, humans, you name it, everything.
There are many other examples across the world similar to this, where it's becoming increasingly apparent that it's not just the plant or even the population that we have to conserve. We also need to conserve the ecological processes associated with them, the whole ecosystem. As we'll hear, this involves a consideration of all aspects of biodiversity, from communities, populations, species, right down to the genes.
A useful weed.
June 2000 brought the first great scientific breakthrough of the new century. The principal players in the Human Genome Project came together to announce the first working draft of the human genome and to bask in the adulation of their political leaders. It was going to reveal the hidden hand of cards dealt by our genes, so we could second guess and, if necessary, cheat our genetic destiny.
Today we are learning the language in which God created life. With this profound new knowledge, humankind is on the verge of gaining immense new power to heal. Genome science will have a real impact on all our lives.
6 months later, a weedy little plant became the equivalent for mapping plant genes. Mouse ear cress is about as nondescript a bit of greenery as its name suggests, but it has a unique distinction of being the first plant to have its whole genome fully sequenced. The hype over the human genome sequencing overshadowed this breakthrough, but to plant scientists, such as Professor Mike Bevan of the John Innes Centre, who led the European sequencing effort, its importance was clear.
This little weed is very important for understanding many complex processes. The DNA sequence itself, in which we have uncovered 25,000 genes, will create many opportunities for new types of experiments for scientists.
The 20th century had begun with the rediscovery of Mendel's insights, which led to the proof of the existence of genetic characteristics in plants. The century had now ended with the sequencing of the entire genome, or the list of genes that make up the plant Arabidopsis thaliana. It's an unpretentiously small plant, approximately 20 centimetres tall, and when first grown looks rather like a water and cress plant, a feature presumably responsible for its common name, mouse-eared cress. However, the beauty of this plant for genetic research is that it has a relatively small genome, allowing it to be used as a model organism for genetic mapping of plants. Historian Jim Endersby.
Arabidopsis are small, they're cheap, they're easy to replace. If one of your students kills a whole roomful of them, it's not the end of the world. They have all these advantages from a very practical point of view. The first plant to have its genome sequenced is very important because it provides a kind of baseline against which all other plants can be compared and contrasted. There are much more important crops economically whose genomes were being sequenced at the same time, rice, maize, things like this, much more complicated for all kinds of reasons, sometimes just many more genes, but often lots of genetic complexity. So getting something relatively small and simple and working on that provides a kind of useful model against which other organisms can be compared. It's a very good teaching tool, but it allows all kinds of basic research to be done. And knowing the genome is, as it were, having the kind of working manual to refer to of what's there.
Having a complete genome was one thing, but the task was then to figure out which genes were responsible for which activity, including basic functions like budding, blooming, and rooting. It was rather like having a roadmap without the street names. Scientists had to work out which gene was responsible for which function, or in other words, putting the street names on a blank roadmap. Professor Liam Dolan is a plant scientist at the University of Oxford. He works on identifying the genes controlling the development of rooting structures, which he showed me to dramatic effect when we compared two plants growing on agar gel plates in his lab.
On one plate, you've got this massive white cells, these rooting structures, whereas on the other plate you can see there's no hairs. So the only difference between these two plants is that the gene that controls a regulator of root function has been knocked out in the plant that has no roots, whereas there's a normal functional gene in the plant that's got these rooting structures. Now that tells us that that gene is a positive regulator of root development. If you have the gene, you can make roots. If you don't have the gene, you can't make roots. And it's by using mutation in this way that we've been able to ascribe function to the genes that are discovered in genome sequences.
How do we then apply this to present day challenges like crop production?
What we can now do is begin to manipulate the function of that gene to make a version of the protein that will enhance the formation of these rooting structures that theory tells us should be able to take more phosphate out of the soil.
The complete sequencing of Arabidopsis now gave scientists the manual for going a whole lot further. GM, or genetic modification, refers to plants which contain foreign genetic material which has been transferred to them by means other than traditional breeding methods, for example using a bacterium which is modified to transfer foreign DNA into the plant. The effects of this approach in the lab are clear, as demonstrated by Liam Dolan with his work on root hairs and improving uptake of soil nutrients in rice plants.
Lynn, we're now in the greenhouse and there's two rice plants in front of us, one that's clearly doing much better than the other one, much higher biomass and it's taller and just more robust looking.
So the healthier looking plant here has got longer root hairs than what we call the control plant here. And the way we've done this is we've taken the genes that we know control the formation of these filamentous root hair structures that form on the surface of the rice roots, and we've made a version of this gene that's hyperactive, so it works at a much higher rate in the rice plant than it normally does. And as a result, it produces longer root hairs than normal. These longer root hairs are now able to extract more of the nutrition that's added to the soil. So when we've measured the differences in yield between these two plants in greenhouse experiments, so it's very preliminary work, the plants transformed with this root hair regulator develop approximately 20% more biomass.
They look to be in quite a healthy medium, but what about if you grow these on sort of sandy soils? Do you still see this variation?
We see an even greater impact of the gene if we do these experiments on sandy soil. In those conditions, we see approximately 40-50% increase in biomass in the genetically transformed plant compared to the wild type. And if we can get evidence that shows that these sorts of traits are robust in the field, that there are no unforeseen ecological impacts, they don't impact on ecosystem service provision, I think that this has huge potential.
Concerns over GM vary widely. On one hand, supporters argue that the technology is a vital tool in plant breeding, which can address many of the future challenges facing agriculture and could allow increased yields and more nutritious crops to be produced, particularly for those living in developing countries. Opponents argue equally strongly that GM plants pose unacceptable environmental, ecological, and economic risks, risks such as the unknown effects of introducing GM plants into the environment. Some countries, such as the Americas and parts of Asia, consider this a risk worth taking. For others, including many European countries where consumer resistance has been high, it's not. But to what extent does GM differ from what we've been doing in plant domestication over past centuries? Jim Endersby.
There's a sense in which what Mendel is doing with his peas is GM. He's modifying their genes by carefully selecting things and then crossing particular strains in order to get desirable genes from one strain into another. That's what plant breeding has always been doing. So to some extent, of course, what we're doing is simply accelerating a natural process. And there is a lot of gene transfer that goes on in nature anyway. Plants are actually particularly notorious for crossbreeding with one another, naturally producing hybrids between different species. Nevertheless, I think it's important to recognise that new technologies do allow us to do things that I think could never happen in nature. So there may be a sense in which we've pushed this further than it's ever been pushed before. That doesn't of itself, of course, mean that it's wrong or hazardous or whatever, but it does. We should recognise that we might potentially be opening up possibilities that have never been available before, and with that, hazards that have never existed before.
Away from the glare of GM, another intriguing result emerging from the sequencing of the DNA of individual plants was the size of the genome itself. It soon became apparent from the sequencing results that there was huge variation in the size of different plant genomes. Ilya Lech is a plant geneticist in Kew's Jodrell Laboratory who studies this great variation in genome size across the plant kingdom. So far, this variation appears to be far greater than anything seen in the animal kingdom. Ilya is one of the curators of a growing international database on plant genome size, which is starting to illustrate some really interesting comparisons.
Well, it tells us that plants are amazingly variable in terms of genome size. Certainly flowering plants are probably the most diverse in terms of genome size for any comparable group of organisms. So genome sizes range over 2,400-fold, from the smallest genomes being found in tiny little carnivorous plants to the largest genome found in an endemic bulbous plant growing in Japan.
What's also becoming clear from this research is that the consequence of having a large genome may not necessarily be good news for the plant, and this is one case where bigger might not be better. As information increases on genome sizes, scientists are beginning to realise that large genomes can have huge consequences for plants' distribution and its ability to withstand climatic perturbations.
at the sort of cell level, it takes longer for a cell to replicate its DNA. And then these sort of effects at the nuclear level have knock-on effects at the whole plant level and probably play a role in influencing where and when plants can live and grow and how they respond to environmental change.
So you're saying, in effect, they're slower to respond because they take longer to...
Yes. If we talk about the snake's head fritillary, the genus Fritillaria, it's been estimated that in that species it takes probably 2 weeks to go through that type of cell division that's needed to produce pollen and eggs, whereas in Arabidopsis it's estimated to take 48 hours. So you can see that even if a plant like Fritillaria had all the DNA needed to be an ephemeral plant and grow from seed to seed in just 6 weeks, which is what something like Arabidopsis does, it simply can't do that because it takes so long to replicate its DNA.
So it affects the whole rate of change within the plant?
Yes. And I guess there's another impact of having so much DNA. DNA is very phosphate demanding, the chemical phosphate, because the backbone of the DNA double helix is built up of phosphate. If you've got a very big genome, you can't, you may be excluded from living in habitats which are nutrient poor.
So you start to see the distribution of plants globally, right down at this genomic level, it's having an influence on where things grow.
Yes, it does have.
And how they respond.
Yes, we want to start to look at the global distribution of plants in terms of genome size. It's something yet to be done.
And would you predict then that those with the really big genomes were the plants that were not so resilient to climate change?
I think on balance, if I had to put my money somewhere, I would. But I think there are many factors which affect a plant's response and resilience to climate change. And genome size, I think, is one, but it won't be the only one.
How and why such diversity in genome size evolved are important unanswered questions. Answers to such questions are vital because they shed light on the distribution and persistence of biodiversity. Such knowledge is highly relevant to our ability to predict plant behaviour in a changing world. The technology developed to sequence the human and plant genome at the turn of the century was to provide an important catalyst to many branches of science. Here at Kew, researchers were to pioneer the use of this technology to reinvent a field of plant sciences that had changed little since the 19th century, plant classification. In doing so, they would decipher a detailed timeline of flowering plant evolution and a revolutionary new way to arrange the plant tree of life.
Plants, From Roots to Riches, was presented by Professor Cathy Willis. The readers were Clive Hayward and Ian Redford. The programme was produced by Adrian Washbourne. And to explore more about the plants featured in the series, go to the Plants, From Roots to Riches website, where you can also download the series as a podcast.